The job of the blender is to combine these elements in such a way as to produce an overall flavour.
A wider repertoire of different beverages than ever before.
I think one of the most interesting breweries, and certainly one of the most interesting origin stories for a brewery in Australia.
Single malts, blends, grain whiskies, bourbons and more.
If you want mezcal to be sold around the world, then unfortunately you're going to have to make a compromise.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. It's been a massive year for Lark Distilling Company, which recently announced the $40 million acquisition of fellow Tasmanian distillery, Sheen Estate. Managing Director Jeff Bainbridge joins us this episode, about 18 months after he last spoke with Drinks Adventures, for a two-part story that I've linked to from the show notes. And remember, you can visit drinksadventures.com.au and sign up to the newsletter so you don't miss stories like that one. At the time, Jeff and I discussed the rebadging and relaunch of Lark Distilling, formerly known as Australian Whiskey Holdings, and the process the company went through to exit the disastrous Nant Barrel investment scheme and sell Overeem Whiskey back to the Overeem family. Lark's share price has been on an absolute flyer ever since, with the company reporting strong sales results, having refocused itself on a single whiskey brand and continued to build its whiskey inventory. There's been some criticism, however, about an alleged lack of transparency surrounding the provenance of whiskey released under the Lark name. I addressed those issues with Jeff in this follow-up interview for the podcast. We also discussed some of the recent developments of late in Australian whiskey generally, like the debate around a potential Tasmanian whiskey appellation and the controversial Archie Rose patent. That's coming up after Jeff gives you an update on some of the other changes at Lark Distilling in recent times.
I guess I'd start with people and culture. You know, I think all good organisations at their core, you know, obviously you need a good product, and Lark's an amazing product, and, you know, it's got its heritage and 30-year anniversary, which I can tell you about a bit later, coming up next year. But any program in any business, you know, comes down to the quality of your team and the people and culture and the aspects of that that, you know, really ultimately allow you to succeed. So we concentrated on that. You know, we've had pretty high turnover, if I was, you know, speaking freely and honestly. We have a full-time staff headcount of about 61 people. We've had turnover in 2 years of 65 people. On my leadership team, I've got 8. Chris Thompson's the only one that's remained over the journey since I began. So I'm the second eldest statesman, if that's the right language. I feel like we're really settled now. Our team's in great shape. Our focus is really sharp. We addressed the addressable market. You know, we really started to understand what Lark's positioning was, what it needed to be, what language was appropriate, how we, in some respects, made it more sophisticated and more relevant to different environments, on-premise, off-premise, gifting, you know, night times, day times. You know, we certainly push very hard on innovation and, in particular, product innovation. So our cask finishing program really took hold over the last 18 months, and probably the most tangible way to visualise that is not just the number of releases and the type of releases that, you know, you'd be familiar with, whether it be a Lark Legacy or a Para 100, Para 50 or a Broken Wood or whatever it might have been. But the measure that probably helps drive the share price a lot is 2 years ago we were selling our liquid for $139 a litre. That's in our pocket. Last year we sold it for $216 a litre. So we were able to basically add 55% to the value of the liquid through our programs of communication, channel management, hospitality, direct e-commerce, direct. Our business is 43% direct to consumer now. When I took the business over, might have been lucky if it was 18%. So easy question to ask, James, difficult question to answer, because it's been the most kind of intense period of change, but very much with focus.
There's obviously tremendous consumer appetite for Australian whiskey, even at the sort of luxury kind of price points that some of your whiskies are commanding.
Yeah, I think it's a fair assessment. Yeah, I suspect in the more value categories, there's actually not as great a demand. That's the, you know, that's probably one of the ironies. There's a belief in Australia that to have success, you've got to move into the mass market and go down. And I think we're increasingly seeing, you know, just by the nature of just the wealth creation that's in Australia and how wealthy this country is, period, there is a genuine luxury market and there isn't a necessity to go down. And we're seeing, you know, boutique and collectability, this idea of kind of connection, you know, back to kind of a place that you know or a place you've been. We're certainly seeing experience. You know, testament to that is, so if you come down to the Lark Bar in Tassie and you have the Lark experience, you'll spend $300-$500, and you won't feel that that's something that's, you know, out of whack or inappropriate or overpriced. You know, you'll value it based on the service you got, the environment you're in, the stories you were told, the whiskey that you drank. And, you know, maybe less about what our assessment of that is last year and this year, we were finalists in the IWSC Worldwide Whiskey Producer of the Year. So 2 years in a row, we're being rated in the top five whiskey distillers outside of Scotland. So I think we're doing the right things to really maintain the luxury and unique nature of Tassie whiskey. We're not a mass market whiskey brand. We don't have stills that are big enough. We don't have bond stores enough. We don't have enough whiskey to really go anywhere other than luxury. And it hasn't been a journey that has been fought the whole way by the consumer. In fact, the consumer's embraced it. But it has been on the back of innovation.
You're right. There has been a bit of a narrative kind of suggesting that, you know, some of the existing incumbent distillers are going to kind of get priced out of the market by some of the bigger players that are coming in, and that, you know, there's just going to be pressure on prices and people are going to need to make a whiskey they can sell for, you know, 700 mils for 120 bucks, or they're going to kind of struggle to compete. From what you're saying about, you know, what you're seeing in the market, that doesn't necessarily ring true.
I don't think it's as linear as that, you know, that it's either all on or all off. What I'd say to you is, if you've got great liquid and really relevant communication and appropriate packaging, you don't need to be in $120 and you don't have to fear a $200 plus experience. I think luxury is a category that is a benchmark that's set not just by, you know, whiskey producers around the world. It's set by car brands. It's set by fashion brands. It's set by homeware brands. It's set by, you know, iPhone brands or Apple brands. So there's an understanding of what luxury needs to look and feel like, and you need to deliver it. I still think a lot of Australian companies don't fully understand what luxury should look, feel, and touch points are, and probably put too much pressure on the liquid and say the liquid has to carry it. In my experience, you know, having worked a lot overseas and in various kind of iterations of my life, all the touch points have to be aligned. So I think what Lark's doing really well is, you know, of course we have some inconsistencies, but what we're doing really well is aligning all our touch points to a luxury experience. And then once we deliver that, there isn't resistance. You know, we had really great success at selling Lark at $2,000 a bottle. We have greater success than I expected at $1,000 a bottle. Our sweet spot is probably $250 to $399 a bottle for 500 mils and around that 43 ABV. Now, you know, there's not too many business models that you'd write that up and think you're going to get away with it in Australia. And I wouldn't say get away with it, but you're going to be successful with it in Australia. But we're very fortunate, as you know, James. We're trading off the heritage of Bill Lark, the history of the company, the journey that it's created, and the consistency of what is great product. Chris Thompson's then overlay this fantastic finishing program, which is pushing the boundaries of innovation. What we've noticed, so for example, on our website, 52% of our customers are female and 48% are male. And the age group is, the largest age group is 25 to 35. So we're not your conventional whiskey. We're not trying to be Scottish whiskey, definitely not trying to be Japanese. We're just trying to be true to us. And I was asked recently in a marketing forum if I had to describe Lark as a person, what would it be? And I think everyone was waiting for me to say an old white man with a beard and, you know, looks like Santa Claus, a.k.a. Bill Lark. And I mean that in the dearest compliment to him because he's a good friend. But I said, well, firstly, Lark is a woman, not a man, and she's a fiercely independent Tasmanian. So, you know, that's a very unconventional statement from a traditional whiskey brand, but that's how we're thinking nowadays.
Investors are clearly liking what you're doing. I think I just checked the current share price is $5.11, and I can't recall what it was in April last year, but I bet you can.
Yeah, it's been pretty meteoric rise. I'd say that the company was fundamentally undervalued. If I gave you sort of a framework of reference, we were about 90 cents when we last spoke, maybe $1.10. And so it was just fundamentally undervalued. It was misunderstood. It was poorly run. It was poorly organized. It didn't have control of the expenses. It didn't have a strategy. It didn't have a plan. So I think the valuation today isn't, you know, it looks like it's swung fivefold, but the reality was it was never a 90 cent stock. It was a 90 cent stock because of the competence or the lack of competence of the previous board and management. We've done some smart things, but we've also done some basic things that should have been done as well. Now, the investor community, they're not fickle. We're really fortunate. We have a really good share register. 18 months ago when we first spoke, we were predominantly Tasmanian high net worth individuals. We're now 65% institutions. We're supported by about 15 or 16 institutions, which are A-grade institutions. So we've become an investable institution stock. The dynamic that we had to go through there and explaining our journey to the market, doing some share issues. We've got a really interesting situation now. We've got a bank debt facility in place that is probably the first one for a whiskey company, because as you know, whiskey companies always bleed money and no bank wants to touch you. And if we're successful, you know, my hope and aspiration in this exercise is if we're successful, it'll be something that will be templated and rolled out to other whiskey companies, because you're always chasing yourself capital for reinvestment. Lark's just out of that cycle. But yeah, the market likes us. That's a fair to say.
I've been writing about drinks for about the last decade, and I've never known a sort of a more interesting and dynamic time on the ASX, which, you know, we've got, apart from yourselves, is obviously Mighty Craft and Top Shelf. What do you kind of make of the amount of investor interest there is in this category at the moment?
It's a simple playbook. There aren't too many beverage-specific opportunities on the ASX, so that's the first issue. So there's not many of us, including in wine and beer. So really, when you look for, if you want to invest in alcohol, you don't have too many options. That's the first issue challenge because you know, global consolidation in beer, wine, Treasury Wine Estates, but that's about it. And they've had their own issues with China. So what the market knows is that history repeats itself. So the large international alcohol companies buy the small guy. It's their playbook. Whether they're buying CUB or they're buying a wine brand or they're buying a spirit brand, they're always buying. You study alcohol and global trends, you just see it constantly. So it's not rocket science what we're doing. You know, we're not setting ourselves out, you know, to be a takeover target, but a consequence of our success is that we should and will be bought, because the category that we play in, so that's the $100 and above whiskey market, 80% of that is controlled by five companies. Now, they didn't start 80% of the brands. They just wait till a brand gets to a certain size with a certain pedigree, certain number of barrels, and then they buy it, because they have to acquire growth, because they can't create growth through organic opportunities. So they buy brands and then they push it down their distribution channels. So whether that's relevant to Mighty Craft, less so, you know, unusual kind of collection of assets, and don't see any synergies obviously there. But to me, Top Shelf International, less so, because it's not a luxury product. It's not exportable at this stage. It's really mass market. I think Lark is sitting by itself in a category that is prime. If we continue with our success, it would be highly unusual if there wasn't an attempt to buy us out.
Now, the biggest news, I think, in recent weeks out of Lark has been the acquisition of Sheen. How did that get initiated?
Look, it's been a busy couple of weeks, busy couple of months, actually. So when you go into your whiskey stocks, you're forward planning your sales cycle. Obviously, you can only sell what you've got. You sort of look in the shed. It's a bit, you know, literal what I'm describing. You look in the shed and you're like, mate, where's the whiskey for next year? And they're like, oh, well, 5 years ago we ran out of money, so we didn't make whiskey for 6 months. And you're like, oh, shit. So you take a big gulp. You try and bring some forward, push some back, but you fundamentally have a gap, and we had a gap. We have a really good collegiate relationship John and the team and Risk at the team at Sheen, and they subsequently they also own Callington Mill. So we have a great relationship with them. And I just said to John one day, I said, mate, have you got any whiskey? And he said, yeah, I'll sell you some whiskey. And I said, I need circa 30,000 litres. So during that exercise, what we did is we took samples of 1,000 barrels from Sheen and we picked 300. And we were really pleasantly surprised at what we were tasting. So that was our first aha moment. And then the next aha moment was we've been capacity constrained ourselves. We've been doing some outsourcing. Unfortunately, our primary outsource partner was Adams and they had a fire, so they weren't able to fulfill that arrangement. So we actually, Sheen has been making Lark for the last 5 months. So we got to taste their liquid, loved it, and they've been making Lark. Now, John's in a situation where he's got two distilleries, two brands, and they're both coming onto the market at the same time. And I think if I, without sort of speaking on his behalf, but if he was on this call, he'd say, listen, he just came to the realisation it's hard enough to launch one brand, let alone two. So we had a very pleasant pub lunch in Richmond down there, you know, just in the wine country in Coal Valley, and chatted away. And I said, mate, why don't you sell us Sheen? He goes, all right, why not? And it was it's as simple as that, and it's as complicated as that. You know, it's an ASX public company has to go through a whole series of regulations and routines to pull something like this off. But it's been really smooth, feels really good, feels right. We were in a situation where we had two distilleries, one in the right location in the Coal Valley but land constrained, one in the wrong location out in Bothwell but not land constrained but building and taking on a heritage project. So we were really ultimately looking to pull back from the outsourcing program and you know, control our own destiny. And Sheen, for those who don't know Hobart very well, so as you arrive in Hobart at the airport, that's where Coal Valley is right there. You drive into Hobart and then if you went another 25 minutes north, you would end up at Sheen. So it's actually past Mona. And it's a spectacular, you know, estate in its own right. It's not the most spectacular distillery, hand on my heart. It's similar to the ones that we've got and the sort of subscale and kind of lacking in automation. So we've committed as part of the purchase of the estate, of the barrels, of the cooperage, of the bond stores, we've also committed to build a new 1 million litre distillery down there. So, you know, give or take 16 months from now, that'll be opening. It'll be all from Tassie. So Colmar, great partner down there in terms of making stills and things. So we're pretty excited because when you talk about milestones, that would be a milestone for us in 12, 16 months' time, cutting the ribbon on a greenfield 1 million litre distillery, state-of-the-art, that finally cements Lark with a home and with something that if you came down, James, or any of your listeners, it would be a must-see, must-stop. Whereas at the moment, I'd be somewhat embarrassed to take you to our two facilities because they don't reflect what I previously described as luxury.
Now, that sort of brings us on to something else that I wanted to raise. I mean, Lark has historically been a single malt brand, a single malt distillery. And I guess last year when the name was changed to Lark Distilling, the ASX-listed company, Lark Distilling, Lark's kind of morphed into a brand, hasn't it, which includes some blended whiskies. And there's been a bit of disquiet about that because that's not the way that distilleries, I think, in Scotland operate. What are your thoughts on that?
It has created some controversy and it's always tricky because when you're trying to move forward and push the boundaries and create change and innovation, you're always going to have some equal opposite impact or effect. If I was to just touch on Lark for a minute and take you through the journey, we were Australian Whiskey Holdings. We had Overeem brand, Overeem barrels. We had Nant brand, Nant distillery, Nant barrels. We had Lark brand, Lark distillery, Lark barrels. And it was a complete, excuse my language, a complete head f- trying to figure out how you're going to sell something when you didn't have the barrels and trying to mix and match things because you can't predict demand like that. Overeem, we were not doing justice to it. So we made a strategic decision to sell the brand back to the Overeem family and Mark and the team there have picked that up, Mark and Jane. We decided in that negotiation we were keeping the barrels because we wanted the liquid and we took that liquid and moved it into some of our limited release programs. We did the same with Nant. So we took Nant, we pretty much decommissioned the brand, and we took those barrels and moved that liquid into the Lark Limited program. We put it on the label, and we then released.
When you say you put it on the label, you mean the way it was kind of described was from our Bothwell distillery, which some people might suggest is, you know, kind of trying to gloss over the fact that, you know, it's come from Nant and there is a bit of a stink around that name still, unfortunately.
There is, but if you taste the liquid's magnificent. That's the testament. That's why we got rid of Nant, because it was a pretty average brand with a hell of a history that was, you know, wasn't even worthy of, you know, trying to invest in to do anything with it. So we did create controversy. We then launched a blended whiskey, which is Symphony No. 1. And we really, I decided I wanted to launch that, one, as a introductory price point at like $139, but two, because I wanted to be in a position where if we had odds and ends of different barrels in the wrong spot, or there was an opportunity, or someone in Tassie got in trouble financially and needed to sell some barrels, we at least had a product that we could actually blend into this program. So it was something that's proved successful. It's allowed the consumer to get in there. It's allowed us more flexibility, and it's allowed us to help others. So I'm not sort of holding back from that one. When we first launched it, it looked, hand on my heart, it looked too much like Lark, a Lark single malt. So that has been changed subsequently to emphasize Lark and really make sure that there's no confusion there. We then went down this other path where we were doing the limited release program, and it's really tricky because, as you know, in Tasmania, it's the bond stores have been built up over many years. People have sold barrels to different people at different times, and people picked up barrels here and there. Our bond store was for some really interesting barrels with, you know, interesting, colourful history. And yet we weren't able to tell the consumer where that came from, because we actually had two lawsuits sitting on our desk saying if we told anyone that those barrels were from that distillery, we'd get sued. So you're in this insidious position where the market wants to know, but then on the other side, you get, you know, you're potentially getting sued. So we've
So which, can I ask?
No.
No. Well, my listeners could tell, at least ask.
Well, so. Yeah. One's called Sullivan's Cove, so, you know, there's a little tip for you. And the other was the challenges with the Overeems. And so we sort of were at sixes and nines. If we didn't disclose it, we got bashed by the punter. If we did disclose it, we'd get sued, and we're like, oh, God, how do we?
So trademark infringement.
Yeah. And so we just walked such a tightrope for a while. And so more recently and part of the Sheen acquisition, because Sheen, we're buying the Sheen liquid and the Sheen brand. We're decommissioning the brand. And that Sheen liquid will move into the Lark Limited program and will almost certainly be the Lark export program. And so what we've done now is we've elevated Lark, if you like, we've detached it from a single distillery, and we refer to Lark as the House of Lark. We'll only ever have one brand, and that's Lark. But we will present whiskies from only Tasmania, but we will present them from multiple distilleries. They'll still be single malts. And, you know, where we can, we'll disclose it. Where we can't, we won't. But we are transitioning away from this idea that Lark has to come from Cambridge out of that still, because it's a very traditional mindset, and you may, some of your listeners may hold it to be a truth that's can never be questioned. But it's actually, it's just not how this industry's grown up. It's not how Scotland grew up. It's not how Japan grew up. We've just got to be more reflective of what the real world is, the challenges of operating in that. And as I always sort of say, judge us by the liquid. If the liquid's poor, then, yeah, shoot me and hold me to account. But 2 years in a row, finalists in Worldwide Best Distiller. I think we're, in my mind right now, and I don't want to sound arrogant, Lark is the most innovative distiller in the world. Nobody is releasing the number of products that we are with the variety that it is and the addressable markets. And so I'm really proud of our journey. I accept that it is a dramatically different journey than that we inherited. And it does create tension for people who are wanting us to be purists or wanting us to be what we used to be. And that's not who we are. And I'm sure, you know Bill well enough. I won't speak for Bill, but Bill's not walking around, you know, upset. He's really proud of the work we've done and to restore the brand. He accepts that it's a different journey, and he's had to come on that. And initially he had hesitation about it as well, or reservations. But, you know, we're very much in step with Bill, and we're very much in a place where it's easy for us now to articulate to you, hey, we're the House of Lark. Our brand is Lark. It's only from Tasmania, but it is going to come from multiple distilleries. Now, we are not doing more than one blended malt whiskey, and we've already got that. It's called Symphony by Lark, Little Lark, and that has a very specific purpose. But we are not going to be a blended malt whiskey company. We are a single malt whiskey company, but we will be multiple distilleries.
So that's the labelling change you're referring to now, is that it's Symphony by Lark. Actually, I've got one here. I don't know whether is this sort of the old.
Yeah, that's the old one. So
it's going to be much more.
That one looked too close to the current Lark, and even though you know if you read that label, in three different places it said blended.
Yeah.
But that
does make it clearer. Then I can see that should have addressed people's concerns a bit.
But I've also know, James, there's fights you can win and there's fights you can't win, so don't get in them. So I don't mean to be inappropriate, but I can't win the fight with that that very hardline view, so I just don't engage.
Which is that, you know, a single malt brand can't also be a blended brand. Is that what you mean, that sort of hardline view? Well, and that it can only be one distillery?
One distillery, not so much the blended, the one distillery. Yeah. And I think that one of the things that Chris Thompson now plays back to me and celebrates. He's like, hey, you've given me such an amazing variety of liquid to create that I can use my distilling skills, right? Because before, when you got one single malt coming out of one distillery, it'd be like me asking you to eat chicken schnitzel every night for the rest of your life. And you're like, mate, well, can't I try cooking something else? So what we've done is introduce variety, we've introduced aging, we've introduced alcohol strength, we've introduced, you know, Bothwell creates this beautiful light, softer, almost floral sort of spirit. Nant's got that traditional oily and viscous spirit, you know. Sheen has got almost like that lighter orchard. So we now get to really have fun and energize the category, because the category needs energy. It doesn't need traditionalists. It doesn't need older white men sitting, you know, on a couch having a cigar, thinking that it's their domain. That's gone.
Now that you're constructing a new distillery, a Greenfields distillery, what sort of capability did you want to build into that to be able to kind of innovate more with the production of your new make?
Yeah, look, it's funny because everyone focuses on the still and the copper and the reflux and the jackets and I'm like, all right, well, that's new make spirit's important, but new make spirit is formulaic by its nature, right? You're trying to make the same thing in a repeatable fashion as efficiently as you can. The most interesting part is the wood. You know, if you think about it, you know, the distilling process is, you know, from go to woe is about 20 days, and the wood program is 5 to 8 years. So I was naive to the importance of wood. You know, it's not that I didn't recognise, I just didn't appreciate the complexities and the importance of it to the extent I do now. John at Sheen was way ahead of his time. He built a cooperage there, the only working cooperage on site in Australia at a distillery. He was importing timbers direct out of France and Spain and Portugal. And we've always had a very nice armchair ride because of our relationship with Warren Randall and Seppelsville. But the most interesting thing for Lark going forward is now that we own a cooperage, what we're going to be able to create and experiment with wood. So that's where I see the really fun stuff. Yeah, we are going to be really conscious of how we're building the stills out so that we can replicate the current flavour profiles. We have a very kind of, if I could use the word, world first, which is always a nightmare in business because it means it costs more than it should and runs late, but we built a world first peat smoker. We're playing a lot with peat. We're looking at larger barrels. We're looking at different. So there's so many other elements that you can introduce variety and interest into the spirit other than actually the new make. But the new make, I think what you'll see in our new make is a level of automation that means that the team that are on the floor are there to influence the flavour or to quality control, not to do the manual work that is currently being done.
Well, it sounds like you won't be at any risk of infringing the Archie Rose patent then.
Yeah, I know. I know Will well, and he's a wonderful guy. Like, he really is. And so brave what he's doing, and a real visionary, and just a huge asset for the industry. And I was out at his distillery last week, and my gosh, is that a behemoth. And but, you know, he has a particular way of doing it. And look, I can't criticise him because that's his way of doing it. You know, I know the industry's all a bit worked up about this patent, and there's a lot of kind of conjecture about it. I don't have a firm view on it. At the end of the day, we don't make whiskey that way, so it's of no value to me or no loss. We've got to carry on the Lark tradition, and I think we're doing that well while innovating and growing forward. So, but yeah, it is quite controversial. You were a bit tongue in cheek there, but you nailed it. You nailed it very well, though.
Now, I sort of interpreted what you said earlier that the Nant brand is being decommissioned. I got a press release in June, I think, saying that you'd taken distribution in house. So, presumably there is some whiskey still knocking about labelled as Nant, but that's going to be discontinued.
Not much, and it's almost exclusive with Dan Murphy's at the moment, and you know, whether that continues or not, I'm not sure. But the simple fact is we could take that same liquid and put it in a Nant bottle and sell it for X, or we can take that same liquid and put it through the Lark Limited finishing program and sell it for Y. And to me, you know, I never had any attachment to that brand, and it was probably the reason AWH was so dysfunctional. You know, it bought the wrong business at the wrong time, and then the incumbent CEO decided to prioritise Nant over Lark. God knows why. So I was trying to run away from it as quickly as we could. So it took a little bit longer to kind of get it to where it is today, which is non-core and on its way out. But when I started in the business, 50% of my time we'd be discussing Nant. I would say less than you're the first time I've discussed Nant this year.
Sorry.
Congratulations. No, not at all. It's just so irrelevant to our program. And one of the things that when we analyze, you know, successful brands that of our size that are exporting, but it wasn't three brands, Overeem, Nant, and Lark all going there and confusing the market. It was one brand. And there's absolutely no doubt Lark is the superior. In my view now, Lark is the benchmark for Tasmanian whiskey as a brand and as a product.
Now, I've heard a bit of talk over in recent times just about some work kind of happening behind the scenes, moving towards, you know, a Tasmanian whiskey appellation of sorts. That would basically mean that, you know, to be able to label your whiskey as Tasmanian whiskey, that you'd have to fulfil certain criteria. Is that something that you're across? Is that definitely happening?
Oh yeah. Your sources are good. Look at you. You're all over everything. Look, it's appellation's a really interesting situation because you don't start with appellation. You introduce it after an industry started and got off the ground. The challenge when you do that is that you tend to ride it to the lowest common denominator so that no one gets kicked out. But a weak appellation is a disaster because it's not protecting anything. But the biggest conjecture that, you know, that I've faced in Tassie and Lark and Bill Lark and I for a long time were split on this issue in a big way. He was for the proposed appellation laws and I was dead against them. And because my view is that it wasn't improving the quality of Tasmanian whiskey, and in fact, if anything, it was imposing extra cost on it. So it's been a really fractious issue. It's been a very controversial one. It's had a lot of airtime, and we're getting a better understanding of what each party needs to get out of this. And at the moment, it's still very much work in progress. I don't believe that it's imminently about to be adopted because it doesn't have broad agreement in the industry at this stage. And, you know, if anything, I think conceptually the way you have to think about it, James, is you want a strong appellation, but you've got to give distilleries a chance to get there. You know, you can't say overnight, hey, you can't do it this way anymore, you've got to do it this way. So it's about appropriate transition periods. We did have a huge controversy about bottling. The original proposal was that to call it Tasmanian whiskey, it had to be bottled in Tasmania. And just to give you a sense of what that means, so Lark, Lark will bottle 604,000 bottles this year, and we will do 83% of that on the mainland. We cut it with Tasmanian Water. We send it over in IBCs, and then it gets bottled in Melbourne, because there is no bottling facility equivalent in Tasmania, period. So what was being contemplated was something that was commercially impossible to fulfill. And it doesn't impact the small guy that has a hand filling, you know, and maybe does a pallet a month. Right? And he's like, yeah, of course it can be bottled in Tassie. But, you know, when you look at some of the bigger players now, that Halliers Road, ourselves, and Kellington Mill, we're like, guys, this is not possible to do. So it has been an issue that has taken us to the brink, but we're back from the brink. So that's what I'm pleased to tell you.
Is there any possibility that there will be a bottling capability in Tasmania at some point?
I think inevitably there will when the commercials support it. Right? So, for example, we can buy Colmar, based in Perth, north, just up near Launceston. They make magnificent stills, right? Now, in theory, you could put in the laws that you had to buy Tasmanian stills. But what you would be doing is institutionalising a monopoly where they can charge whatever they want because they're the only people who make stills. Right? So there's, you need, you know, the ACCC get involved in these things. Government, you know, take a very dim view of anything that's anti-competitive or trying to lock away, use appellation to really block competition. If Tasmania is big enough and successful enough at whiskey, there will be a bottling plant. But I don't know if that's going to be in 2 years' time or 10 years' time, but you can't have a set of rules that enshrine it.
And the reality is there's only a small number of players that are operating at a large scale down there too.
You know, there's 48 distilleries, there's 38 that are really, you know, not, there's 10 that are probably out of the back of the car, so there's 38. Of the 38, there's probably five of scale. There's Sheen and ourselves, and we've just bought that, so that makes us four now. There's Kellington Mill, there's Halliers Road, and there's Sullivan's Cove. There's light years. Now, that's what makes Tassie so great, that there's all these little producers and everyone's enthusiastic and they want to come and try something. But, you know, it's a real balancing act because ultimately we still need a viable industry. You know, we need to stand on our own 2 feet, and we have to do that both at scale and at niche. And I think we're close, but we're you know, it's always a challenge because Tassie is very protective. It's an island, and by the very nature of being an island, it's got a fortress mentality. And so, you know, it fights very hard on some of these issues.
Now, tell me about the new whiskey bar. Is that already open or coming soon?
Well, it should have been, but COVID travel restrictions has sort of led us to delay the opening. It'll open on the 1st of December. And Franklin closed during COVID. Great reputation, great building. We negotiated with the landlord to take that up. And rather than open a lark bar, we discussed it as a group and said, well, we'd rather open a bar that celebrates all Tasmanian whiskies. So it's not called Lark Bar, it's called The Still. We'll maintain the original Lark Cellar Door down the road, about, you know, circa 200 metres away. And when you arrive at The Still, you go through a sort of an arrival corridor that has like a hall of fame of every distiller in Tasmania with a little card, and it'll be the only place that ranges all Tasmanian whiskies for either tasting or for takeaway. So it's about a $750,000 investment. And for us, it's about the celebration of Tasmanian whiskey, of which Lark is, you know, a big part of in the story. But it's not just us beating our chest. It's actually bringing others along on the journey with us. And we've had a really good response from the industry. Admittedly, no one's been in it, but the bar looks magnificent. It's got really good energy. It's ready to go. We have a wonderful hospitality business, you know, led by Dan Knight, ex-Merivale in Sydney. Great team, Niall and Chris and Campbell, and great energy. But that'll be our fourth outlet, and then we'll take over the Sheen Cellar Door, so that'll be our fifth outlet. I'm hunting around for a Lark Bar in the Rocks in Sydney. So as the Rocks have been revitalised, and ironically, there's Argyle Street there and we're on Argyle Street, so you never know what might happen. But I'd love to, if you can't come to Tassie, I'd love Tassie to come to you. So, you know, hospitality is a core part of our business. We do it really well, very profitable. But importantly, just this amazing experience from customers when they come and they, you know, they just walk out beaming. And Bill Lark regularly is at the cellar door. So, you know, it's quite novel for people when they, oh that's him.
Awesome. And a big milestone coming up next year, which you mentioned earlier as well.
Yeah, look, May 28, 2022 is the 30-year anniversary of Lark, you know, and We all know the story of the fly fishing and then changing the laws and then on the kitchen table with Lynn, Bill and Lynn. You know, when I chat to Bill about the program for next year, you know, there's an official function by the ADA in Melbourne where we'll be guest of honour. Lynn and Bill will be guest of honours. We're actually inviting all the ADA members who have whiskey to submit a sample, and that we'll be creating a special ADA blended 30-year celebration that will be given out at the ADA function. You know, we've got a new logo and livery coming out. We've got a 30-year rondelle coming out. So if I could say it this way, May 28 for me is a milestone of celebration, respect and authenticity, but May 29th is an opportunity for us to take the brand somewhere else and not necessarily get stuck by, you know, it's kind of nostalgia. So we've got some big events happening. You know, I think there'll be quite a bit of press as well because it's the birthplace of Tassie whiskey. It's something to be celebrated. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a really, really strong 6 months for us.
Fantastic. Well, I'll look forward to that, as I'm sure everyone will. So thanks very much for joining us on the show.
You're more than welcome, James, and greetings to your viewers, and I hope everyone has a nice Christmas.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.